I love it when you pop a Vuln quick.
Yeah.
You know, I did that on a program. It's so satisfying.
That's like the opposite of imposter syndrome. It's like, oh, I'm a god. You know, for a split second, you're like, I'm the best.
All right, hackers, I was just looking into this and I think I figured out how ThreatLocker Elevation Control works, okay? So when a user launches an elevated process, or they try to, ThreatLocker agent will hook that into its own elevation flow, so we don't see any UAC prompt or anything. The ThreatLocker admin will be able to grant that process elevated permissions for a certain amount of time or whatever, very granular control there. And then the ThreatLocker agent on the user's device injects a modified process security token, which will elevate that process directly. This is awesome because it avoids things like UAC, which leaves NTLM hashes and stuff like that in memory, right, in LSAS.exe. It creates a time-bounded elevation, right? And it does the elevation to the process rather than to the user. Really great stuff. But of course, there's always like maintenance mode and that sort of thing if you have to get in there and do a bunch of administrative activities. Great stuff by ThreatLocker once again. All right, let's go back to the show. What's up, hackers? We got the This Week in Bug Bounty segment real quick, and we've got a couple items here. First one is that the Adobe team wanted us to let you know that they are going to be at B-Sides London. They're a platinum sponsor this year, and they would like to meet some of the community out there in London. So if you're going to be at B-Sides London, drop by, look for people that are wearing Adobe swag, and go up and say, hey, they'd love to connect with y'all. The next one up was this one right here, which is a HackerOne report on Cloudflare that recently got disclosed. And I wanted to shout this out because of how beautiful this bug is. It's entitled Bypass of Cloudflare's Cache Keys in WAF via Header Overflow. And essentially what happened here is that the attacker was able to provide a large amount of headers, right? 94 in this scenario. And this would overflow the maximum number of headers for Cloudflare's cache key. And the cache key is the thing that determines what a unique page is as far as caching goes. And you can see some of the things that are in Cloudflare's cache key by default are things like the X method override header, X HTTP method override header, the sort of things that will break the backend probably if they're included, right? And they shouldn't be cached with the main asset. But if you were able to provide one of those after a certain number of headers that made it exceed the max number of 100 headers, including the internal headers added by Cloudflare, then you would be able to sneak those in and get your resource cached with the malicious HTTP method override key or header in there. And that would result in stored XSS or DOS. I just thought this was a beautiful one to shout out. And I whenever these things pop up on Hacktivity, I'm like, wow, that's been sitting there for so long. And we could have found that just by sending a bunch of headers. Beautiful. All right. Last but not least, for those of you on YouTube, you can see that I'm wearing this sick, ugly Christmas sweater that Wiz sent us. So I just wanted to give a shout out to the Wiz team. Thank you for this beautiful, what is it? It's like Arctic intelligence, AI security, ugly Christmas sweater. So I'm gonna be wearing this one all holiday season. Thanks, Wiz team. All right, let's go. Let's jump into the show. All righty, man, we're rolling. Happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah, happy Thanksgiving. And for some reason, you think that half the world won't know what that is. Do you want to tell people what it is?
I mean, it's an American holiday. I don't think it's a given that people will know what that is.
Yeah, I feel like that people have probably heard of it and know what it is, even if it's not celebrated, but...
Maybe, yeah. Maybe. I just feel like I don't know the holidays for a lot of other countries.
That's fair.
Yeah.
That's fair.
But I guess like a lot of businesses and stuff do operate off of like US holidays and stuff like that. So,
yeah. So anyways, Thanksgiving is a holiday where people talk about what they're thankful for and eat specific types of food.
Yeah. What are you thankful for this year, man?
Oh, that's a great question. So it's my first year doing full-time bug bounty. I think I've doubled my annual goal. So yes. Praise God for that. It's amazing. So yeah, but outside of that, I think from the hacking community, I'm like extremely thankful for, I guess, openness of information. Like I think that the openness of like GitHub, for example, has made AI models incredible at coding. And I just get benefit from that every single day. Totally. And then I just think in the hacker community, like we didn't have to develop The hacker community didn't have to develop in such a way where people wanted to share information. I think all the time about how people travel to conferences all over the US for basically zero pay to share niche research to like 15 people in a room. And sometimes it blows up, but like they're really excited about it. They've been prepping all year, dude. Like they've been working hard in their off hours. They have a salary job and they're going to go and present at this conference in DC to 15 people in a small room about their little niche area of research. It's like, man, the security industry is really cool in that regard.
It is, man. It is. The dissemination of information. Yeah, for sure. People just love talking about it. I think people are really passionate, you know? Which makes sense. Yeah, dude. I'm thankful for having you on the team this year.
Well, thank you.
It's been amazing to be hosting the podcast with you. I'm also grateful for the whole CTBB team. They just are unbelievable. So I know they're editing it right now. I can see their little stupid smiles. So thank you guys for all of your hard work. And for the CTBB community as well, dude. Like, this community is so awesome because, like, one of the things we were thinking about when we built this community in the beginning, Joel and I were like, man, we really wish this community existed so that we could be a part of it.
That's right.
And then I'm just sitting there, like, in the Discord reading all the stuff, and I'm like, man, this is great. Like, wait, this is my baby. Like, this is so awesome.
It really does feel like you get to like reap the rewards of the awesome thing that you built when people are like sharing novel research, when they're collaborating, when they're popping insane bugs, when they're like sharing their bounties and their success stories that community has contributed to, right?
Yeah.
I was thinking about that recently too. Obviously, we have a few different things we're kind of doing for promo for Thanksgiving and Black Friday that I want you to mention after I say this. But I was actually thinking about, man, how cool it is that we are in an industry where we get to actually pat the backs of our friends in ways that are financially meaningful to them and their family. Like me and Douglas Archangel were hacking on a thing this week, and I thought about that. Like, he got me invited to a private challenge or whatever, and it resulted in, you know, five plus. Or I think it's going to result in five plus figures of bounties. And it's just like, wow, that is so cool that I have a friend who like kind of like shares that type of I don't know, blessing or gift with my family on like a regular basis. It feels crazy. Dude.
Private program invites or like challenge invites and stuff like that are pretty meaningful. GrepMe got me into one the other day and I was like, dang, we crushed this. This is great. Thanks, man. Like, and it's funny for him as well, because, you know, he was my mentee for like, I don't know, a year and a half, 2 years, you know?
Yeah.
And then I'm like, yes, I'm reaping the reward of my...
Exactly.
So...
And just even small leads, though, like the reason why my mind jumped to this is because like there's a small scale of that happens in our community, in the Critical Thinkers chat or in the guild chat, where people are just posting leads. And it's like, hey, I think I have a gadget here. Can I turn it into a bug? And then people are like, oh, here's the bug. And then they both get paid. And so it's really cool because it's like a gift to both people that like, had they not had that connection, nobody would have got paid.
Yeah, it's beautiful too. I mean, especially in the C tiers tier, a lot of people will drop stuff all the time. Like, hey, you know, how do I solve this? And then somebody gives them the answer and it's like, well, that just paid for 10 years of CTBB. You know?
Exactly. Like, yeah, exactly.
Like, all right, here we go. So, well, going back to the Black Friday thing though, what we're going to do just as a part of Black Friday, for those of you guys that don't know, Black Friday is like a, I don't know, consumeristic
shopping,
American
consumer,
holiday.
Yeah,
call time. It that. Where all the, you know, companies try to give deals and stuff like that. And essentially what we're going to do is we're just going to give out 5 to 10 free swag codes for Black Friday in the CTiers Discord surrounding Thanksgiving and Black Friday. So if you guys are interested, hop into the Critical Thinkers tier where we're going to be dropping those swag codes and get some. And we're also going to do a raffle for the new paperback version of Gareth Hayes' JavaScript for Hackers. Okay. So he's, Gareth is doing a little promotion, I think surrounding Christmas and surrounding the holidays, releasing the paperback version of his amazing book, JavaScript for Hackers, which I recommend all of you guys listen to and have recommended to you multiple times already.
Yeah.
So here's the paperback version right here. We're going to do 3 copies to existing Critical Thinkers. We're going to raffle those off. And then we're going to do 3 copies to new Critical Thinkers that join surrounding Thanksgiving and Black Friday. So be on the lookout for those Black Friday and Thanksgiving opportunities.
Such an appropriate price there of the book.
Yeah. Yeah, dude. I 1337.
You didn't even notice.
I didn't even notice, man. Oh, God. Am I a hacker? I don't even know if I'm a hacker anymore, dude. Jeez.
That's funny. The Kindle version or the audiobook version should be like $137 or something.
Yeah. True. All right, man, let's jump into the content. I'll go ahead and take the first one since I'm already sharing my screen. The first one that I wanted to cover with you guys today was Searchlight Cyber's research on CV-2025-61757, which is Oracle Identity Manager's pre-auth RCE. And guys, this one was such a simple bug. Like, it's just a beautiful example of like what you can do when you actually take the time to get access to source code, okay? So, as usual, Searchlight Cyber team doing research, picking apart enterprise applications. They grabbed the source code for Oracle Identity Governance Suite and started tearing it apart and found a bunch of EAR and WAR files. The first thing that I kind of noted about this write-up was that they do what lots of us hackers call the find the endpoint game. I think Sam Erb was the first one that coined that, in my knowledge at least. And essentially, they knew about a file, help pages main.jspx. And they were like, okay, well, we know that file exists from just playing around with the app. So let's go find where that is, right? So they grepped through all the WAR files and found it deep within the file system there. And then they started tearing apart the jars surrounding that and found that oracle-idmuishell.jar was the jar file that had all of the main functionality for the application in there. So they started looking at all the routes and stuff like that, and they noticed that a couple of them were unauthenticated. So they tried to reach out to them, but they hit a 401. And they're like, what the heck is going on here? These are unauthenticated routes. Like, why are we hitting a 401? And so they take a peek back at the web XML file and find that something that we love to see, guys, that all of the security constraints for these routes are being implemented by one central security filter, which is like bad news. Okay. So this is like a good overarching principle that you could take into other enterprise applications. And this is I'm just going to read a quote from the write-up right here. At Searchlight Cyber, we have found that central filters like this are almost always bypassable. The reason tends to be as follows. The security filter handles every route in the application, but there's almost always a set of routes the developer wants to allow for all users, including unauthenticated ones. Mm-hmm. So we saw here just like a traditional story of, auth bypass here, where they found that the developers were trying to let access to all WADL files through, and they were able to hit any arbitrary route by just tacking ... .WADL at the end of that route.
Such a classic example of just like, a filter that's regex based that you can just find a funny bypass to, right?
Exactly, man. Exactly. And, but one little gotcha that they did have here was, of course, they started with, question mark. But then actually, they were using get request URI, not get request URL. So it had to be in the actual path itself.
Oh, interesting.
But then Java comes to the rescue with path parameters. So they were able to just do ... .WADL. And then get RCE via hitting a route called Groovy Script Status, which takes some Groovy Script in and compiles it and then tells you whether there's compilation errors. But it doesn't actually execute the code. So they had to know, they solved that problem to get RCE by knowing that Java annotations are processed at compile time.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Yeah. So even though the code wasn't actually run, the annotation, the custom annotation that they defined was being run because those are run at compile time, and they were able to get arbitrary code execution through a annotation that they passed into that endpoint. Mm-hmm. So, dude, that's pre-auth RCE, really cool. GG, dude.
Yeah, the goal, the dream.
Yeah, beautiful. So, shout out to the SL Cyber team.
Was an awesome write-up. That was like published yesterday or today?
Yeah, I think it was
pretty recent. Yeah, that's awesome.
Yep, we'll link it in the description.
Sweet, dude. I brought us a write-up from HX. Many, many people know HX01 as the SSO or OAuth guy. I don't know if you've ran into him in a while. He was doing the life hacking circuit for a little bit, but...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've seen this.
Yeah. So I'm going to share my screen real quick. It's called Who Needs a Blind XSS? And so it's kind of interesting. I think this is like years in coming. I remember like actually playing with this exploit back with HX and Eric back in the day, like a couple years ago. I'm friends with both of them. I think that there's a third person. Yeah, Sajib. And so basically what they did was, and you've seen this before because we've used it with AI stuff, but they're using the import HTML Google Docs function.
Oh, Google Docs function. Okay.
Yes. To basically concatenate the, you know, the top left data, but you could do any data, you know, in a real attack scenario with their server so that it automatically leaks. Obviously, I'm sure that a lot of people have probably heard of this strategy. And if not, it's really neat. Basically, Google Docs, when you open the tab, if there's an import HTML, will make like a client side fetch request, very similar to AI related image markdown vulns, right? Where there's like a client side from the victim's browser fetch with that data. And it includes the dynamic data from the table. And so it gets leaked. I was actually going to ask you before I go on to this, is there a word for that whole class of attacks? Like, you know, like image source, import HTML, or is it just called like a client side?
Are you talking about like CSV injections in particular here? Because that's pretty much all you do with CSV injections is like, you know, exfil data via like a HTTP function or something like that.
No, I'm just talking about like, but like, you know, like for example, if you have an AI application that's rendering markdown images into like an image source tag, the browser, the like the victim's browser is making a client-side fetch to a attacker server in order to leak the data. And that's exactly what this does, but it's a completely different mechanic, right? Like this is like some sort of like, you know, fancy JavaScript in the in the Google Sheets thing that's doing it rather than like an image source tag for markdown. But at the core component, they're both leaking it via a dynamic URL coming from the client-side browser. And so I didn't know if there was like an overarching term for both of
those. Not that I can think of, man. I mean, just leaks via, you know, HTTP request, I guess. But like, you know, even something like, it's not really like a client side or like a cross site leak because it's not necessarily done that way.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, anyways. I don't know. Yeah. It is an interesting vuln category though.
Yeah. They're similar in that way. And I would be interested in, if something like this could be used with import HTML with like an image thing for that image refer vulnerability, like that 0 day that was in Google, it did work in markdown to image source in AI apps, but I'm curious if it would work in something like this. Anyways, I digress. Basically, their goal was to spray this type of payload, import HTML with, you know, with a domain that they owned with a concatenation of the data so they could prove, you know, data exfil across a bunch of different locations, across a bunch of bug bounty programs to see if they would get callbacks to their server. If anybody's ever tried this with Google Forms, it sanitizes it. And there are lots of other apps that sanitize it. So I did want to call out, and they didn't get a lot of success initially, but success came days and weeks later when that data was then used at some point by an employee down the line. And so there are two ways that this happened that they found. One was employees exporting CSVs from CRMs like Salesforce or Zendesk or HubSpot. You know, these may have things that escape it locally when you view it. Well, I mean, none of these are going to run a Google Docs function anyway, but and because they're not Google Docs, they don't have a reason to sanitize the data.
Right.
When you import into certain ways from Google Docs, it does get sanitized. But what they found was that when you copy and paste it, it doesn't always do it. And then two, automation tools like Zapier, WorkAuto, and other custom integration insert the rows directly into Google Sheets. So things like this. So this is like a Zapier for the listeners. There's a screenshot on their blog post that just shows like a Zapier extension that allows you to take a CRM lead from Salesforce and basically automatically put it into Google Sheets. So anyways, they got a bunch of hits. The funniest one, which I just have to mention on the pod before we move on, is that a bug bounty live hacking event form was one of the exploits they saw. And look, it looks like it has, please provide researcher information, something about being invited. So I'd be really curious to know which company this was, but
dude, yeah. That's hilarious, man.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. I think that blind, you know, injections like this always, they just boggle my mind when they work. I'm like, oh yeah. My gosh, I just can't believe that happened. Mm-hmm. But yeah, totally. I mean, I could definitely see how Zapier connections or something like that, you know, would really make that happen because there's no reason to have it sanitized, you know, when the row is getting inserted. So yeah, that makes sense. But man, that's such like a shadow IT thing too, though. It is like, if your team is like, your marketing team is like spinning up a form and then they connect it to Zapier and then it leaks all the information submitted by the form, you're like, what is it? The company's going to be like, okay, guys, all right, yeah, here's the bounty, you know, but like, what, how do they fix that? You know, like,
yeah, that's true. This is something that I can see not getting paid from some programs because there's not like a code base fix, right? It's like, tell your employees not to do this silly thing. But if it is via a Zapier extension, then maybe it would automatically get paid because you can go import the data in a better way, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Potentially. Good shout, man. Yeah. I like to see it when people talk about it more than just theoretically. They're like, okay. And then we went and submitted every single Salesforce form that exists, you know, or whatever, you know, to see if where this data would end up back in Google Sheets or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. I think HX kind of had the idea, but then reached out to Eric, and I'm pretty sure they've been doing this for at least like more than a year. So I think they've probably sprayed it everywhere and gotten a good number of bounties from it.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense, man. Good stuff, guys. Next one on the list that we had here was actually a Crit Research Lab post, which, guys, I've been so pleased with the results of the research lab. We kind of came up with this idea to sponsor research by people in the community, and we've gotten some really good finds out here. So this one is entitled ASP.NET MVC View Engine Search Patterns by FSI. And essentially the concept of this research is that FSI takes a look at the scenario where you have arbitrary file write on a ASP.NET environment, but you can't access the files that you're writing because there's no paths that allow you to access .aspx files or CSHTML right. files, so you can't get code execution. So what he did in this scenario is, and he breaks it down in a lot more depth in the actual blog, but he hooked Procmon up to the actual exe that was processing all of these hits and found that it was attempting to read a bunch of paths of files that don't exist when he hit a certain model view controller path in the ASP.NET framework, right? So essentially there's like a default file that it will try to read, you know, that ends in .cshtml or whatever when you try to hit some of these, what is it? Let's see if I can find the one right here. When you try to hit a path like /model/view or /controller/view right here. And then it will take that, it'll take your controller name and your method name, and then it will craft a an actual file that it tries to read from the file system and executes that code, right? So if you've got access to like the MVC interface, right, but you can't access the actual file itself, you can use your arbitrary file write to write into one of these, you know, files that the system looks for by default, and then it will go ahead and process that and run that code as the result of this MVC interface here. So I thought this was really great research. I love it when researchers dive deep into specific frameworks that we see all the time, like ASP.NET, right?
Yeah.
And give us a write-up of exactly what's happening under the hood so that we can know better how to exploit some of these niche scenarios.
Yeah, 1,000,000%, because all it takes is this one person putting out this research. And now everyone who comes across a similar situation knows how to like further the exploit, you know, how to actually get the next step or the amount of impact.
Exactly. And you know, one of the things he was saying specifically here is that a lot of times what you'll see in these web.config files is that only specific file extensions are allowed, or, you know, the dot file extension is allowed, which means an empty file extension, and that correlates really well with the MVC environment. That's why, you know, he had this very limited allow list, and he was able to use that to still arbitrarily execute code via a CSHTML file. Right. So pretty awesome.
Dude, and on the topic of the Crit Research Lab in general, like you said, I feel like we were excited about it and you launched it, and then like we didn't really do a lot with it for a while, but then over the last 2 months, it's just been like bam, 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 bam. So it's been so good.
Yeah. It feels like every episode we're talking about something new. So exactly. If you're interested in trying to figure out some ASP.NET MVC stuff, then this is a great write-up. And if I remember correctly, I think I've got an unread message by FSI right now trying to do a follow-up to this. So you might see a follow-up on the Crit Lab Research website. So,
and I don't know if it was him or someone else, but we have had some people say, hey, instead of this little token bounty, can I just get some swag? And so if you're wanting to earn some swag, you can also do a small write-up for swag.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. Definitely down to give CTVB swag instead of, you know, the $25 to $50 that we do for a lot of these write-ups and micro research.
Yeah. Okay. Sweet. The next one, you said, what the heck is this? And I said, wait until we're on the pod to talk about it. First of all, it has a really cool name. It's called Heretic, but it is AI related. So I'm going to share my screen super quick for the viewers.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Oh, you're already skimming it, Justin.
I'm sorry, man. I'm sorry, dude. Blow me away.
Oh, it's fine. No, it's actually just extremely cool new research, and it does stand on the shoulders of giants. So basically, there's a thing called obliteration, and it's a way in which there are people who remove the safety alignment from open source models. You know, obviously this has pros and cons. We're not here to debate the ethics of it, but it's often useful for security researchers and hackers because some of these models will be very resistant to helping write payloads and do that sort of thing. And so kind of having this strategy to obliterate or like kind of remove the safety alignment from top open source models in the future will be really useful for people like us and people like our community that want to use open source models for exploit writing. And this is basically the latest and greatest breakthrough in that. Generally, when you obliterate a model, it reduces the quality of the model by a huge amount. And I don't understand what all these words mean. A lot of this is AI ML speak, but basically the KL divergence is what they say goes down significantly. And they basically solved that. So they solved it where now you can obliterate the model, but leave the quality really high. And this repo makes it totally possible for anyone to do it. Like just it's basically just running the script. You don't have to do anything fancy and it kind of just figures everything out for you.
Wow, dude.
Yeah, they did it on Gemma and Quinn. But one of the coolest things is basically they have a list of harmful prompts and the default Google Gemma 3 12 billion parameter model refuses 97 of the 100 harmful prompts. So there's probably just three like duds in there, right? Like things that aren't actually harmful or whatever in their data set. But then after it's obliterated, it only rejects 3.
Dude, that's pretty sick.
Yeah, it's really, really cool. The fact that it, and they say down here at the bottom that it's built on top of auto obliteration, obliteration.py, and a bunch of these other things that's prior art, basically, that kind of inspired them and made the technique possible. But it's just a really cool breakthrough for getting a model to be like, quote unquote, you know, fully jailbroken or fully like,
Yeah, I think that's going to be, I think within the next year or so, we're going to see a lot of the stuff that we want to be able to accomplish in cybersecurity being able to be done by local models.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you would want to do it at a local model for sure. You know, like, having to fight with it to like, you know, hack something.
I promise I'm really a bug bounty hunter and this is the scope. Hey, you want a tiny trick that I think has been working for me a little bit lately? What? Often I do actually want like a header, an X bug bounty header in my requests. But mm-hmm. I've been putting that in the very first request. Anytime I ask these like agentic frameworks, whether it's Codex or Claude Code, I'll be like, make sure you append this header to any request you make, you know? And so then it writes it into the script and then it's less likely to reject you because I've noticed that Sonnet 4.5, if I'm not careful, will often reject me where Sonnet 4 didn't. So I do think that they are trying to make their models safer over time. Actually on that topic, Anthropic does have a private bug bounty program. You can just like fill out a form to request access to, and they do quite well. I think we've talked about them on the pod once or twice, but some of my AI red teaming friends all got payouts this week and they were pretty significant payouts. You know, it was like 18,000, 14,000, 12,000. And then like, you know, a couple that were like 2, 4, 6. And this is for jailbreaks. This is not for like security vulnerabilities. It's for safety issues. Right. And so anyways, yeah, I just wanted to mention that because I do think the companies are continuing to care more and more about safety. And that's going to make it harder and harder for us to generate payloads later. So things like this Heretic are really cool. So,
dude, those are some serious bounties for jailbreaks, like 5-figure bounties.
It is. Wow. Yeah. And these people are not people who are like into bug bounty before. So for them, it's like kind of like, you know, hooking them. So
they're seeing the beauty of it all. That's exactly. I love that, man. Exactly. Yeah, dude, freaking bug bounty, man. It is unbelievable. It really is. All right. So
you go.
I got the next one. This one is here. Let me go ahead and share this. This is actually a presentation that I stumbled upon as I was just scrolling through Twitter. And the guy that retweeted it was Sojal Sec, 0x0 Sojal Sec. I don't know if it's his presentation because there's nothing, you know, in the actual presentation that says who this is. But the title of it is Lesser Known Techniques for Large-Scale Subdomain Enumeration. I was like, okay, let me just like you know, thumb through this really quickly.
I glazed over this. I didn't look at it because I thought it was going to be stuff we've all seen before.
And then I was like, okay, let me just look at this really quick. And technique number one was ENTs and no errors, which is something that we've talked about on the pod before, but actually is, you know, what I would categorize as a less known technique for doing subdomain enumeration. And essentially, what this will tell you is whether there is a node without resource records, but there are descendants, right? So if you've got, you know, justin.ctbb.rhinorator.com and you hit ctbb.rhinorator.com and there is descendants, right? It'll tell you whether or not, whether there's a record that's below it, right?
Nice.
If there's justin.ctbb. So this is a really helpful piece for knowing whether you're getting good coverage. And this was something that I think we covered in the masterclass with NBK in the exclusive content for their critical thinkers. But I did want to shout it out as well to anybody that's really into the subdomain enumeration game and wants to get really, really good coverage. Knowing how to utilize these ENTs and no errors will help you make sure you're getting coverage and identifying and not, you know, and not wasting time trying to get access to records that are that don't have any descendants, right? You don't want to be brute forcing underneath something that doesn't have descendants,
right?
So I thought that was a cool one to shout out. Have you heard of that one before, Joseph?
No, I have not. And is this like independent of whether it's a wildcard or not?
That's a good question. I'm not actually sure if it has wildcard. I'm not sure how wildcards affect this. Actually, that's something to look into. Yeah,
because that's what my mind goes to. Is like, you know, it's often nice to fuzz or look for domains where there's wildcard.
But you can detect wildcards, you know, like but I mean, you're talking about an exception?
Well, I'm just saying, like, this would be like another case. Like, if you're building some system, right? It's like, yeah, well, let's make sure we run, you know, like a common file name or like known words that are associated with an organization whenever there is a wildcard. But then this would also let you know that you need to do it in other non-wildcard cases too. Did you say this tells you that the descendant is Justin or no?
It tells you that there is a descendant.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So then you do have to kind of like go fuzz for it, right? Or is there some way to then pull it?
Yeah, no, there's not a way to just pull it. Well, actually, okay now that you mentioned that, there is a another one, which is very interesting, which is NSEC zone walking. And I've heard of zone walking before. I thought that was like, you know, an older technique. And I think, you know, a lot of times it's not working nowadays. And sometimes it does work. But essentially, this one is, I'm just going to read this line from the presentation. NSEC is a DNSSEC record type that proves non-existence of a DNS record by pointing to the next existing name.
Oh, that's cool.
Which is crazy. And I obviously, you know, that has its problems, but apparently there's NSEC 3 now, which returns hashed names instead of actual subdomains, but that's still super helpful, right? So you can take those hashes, pull them offline, and then try to like offline.
You can maybe crack them. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's, and that's going to be a lot more efficient than trying to, you know, brute force for.
Oh, and there's already a tool linked there for the cracking. That's sick.
Yeah. Yep, NSEC 3 map is what it's called. So this one I actually really hadn't heard of. I don't know how often this is used. I've not tried this technique before, but definitely something worth looking into. And I feel like, you know, worst case scenario, you know how many records there are, which is a cool thing to know, you know, and you've got the set of hashes that might just, you know, crack, boom.
Dude, that's so cool. I mean, anyone who does big recon definitely needs to install NSEC 3 map and start cracking those hashes if they can find that for any domains. That's really cool.
Yeah, for sure. And then number three was ICANN's CZDS, which is Centralized Zone Data Service. And I love this. It's just, it just says, you know, anybody who is interested in getting access to the zone files for participating top level domains can just request zone files for a whole TLD.
Also known as NAFI.com.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
A place to go request zone files. That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. So, very interesting. I wonder which TLDs are on there. I haven't.
One second. I'm going to go, register for this portal. Shut up. Okay. I'm not joking. I really want to, but.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So, I mean, but it'd be interesting, you know, a lot of times some of these companies will be like, trying to do something cool with their domain name, you know, like do like the first part of their name. Like, for example, we own kai.do at Kaido, right? Like, what the heck is the do, you know, TLD, and does this, you know, centralized zone data service
seriously
have all of the zone files for that whole, you know?
That would be crazy.
Yeah. So could be some really good wins there if a company is using an obscure TLD.
Yeah, do you think it's only obscure TLDs? I guess it would be. For any main ones, it would be ginormous.
Yeah, dude,
it
would be huge. No way they're giving out like .com zone files or something ridiculous like that.
Is that even possible? Do you think that exists? Is there a DB of like all com? I mean,
It's got to, because that's how the DNS architecture works, you know? I guess they distribute it out to authoritative name servers or whatever, but either way, it's helpful. So.
Yeah, that's cool. Good find, dude. I'm glad you ended up skimming that. Like I said, I just glazed over it and I should not have.
Yeah, I thought that was cool. All right, you got something else on the list here?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I was going to mention, this is like maybe two things. I'll mention both Gemini 3 and Antigravity.
Oh, yeah.
People probably already saw this, but Gemini 3 dropped yesterday, I think, and it's just like crazy good. I mean, it on a lot of benchmarks, it's like the first like big gap, you know, like you see like these little tiny steps as new models come out. And for some of these, it's like a huge leap for some of these benchmarks. And obviously benchmarks are not everything. There are a bunch of models that do well on benchmarks that then kind of struggle when you go to use them. I've heard that's true on Kimi T2 or whatever.
Yeah.
But I mean, obviously Google puts out great models. And what's absurd about this is you can go use it on AI.dev right now for free. Literally any in the world, just go to AI.dev and use it for free. And you can turn thinking on high there and it's great.
No way. Wow. I didn't
know that. And I think even like just normal pro subscribers can go to gemini.google.com and turn on thinking with a little drop down there. And so, yeah, you basically have a thinking model of the best model in the world. I think more people should be throwing crazy problems at Gemini 3.
Yeah.
I do this all the time. You know, like I'm specifically doing it in this area of research with Markdown HTML with Valentina right now. Mm-hmm. I'll basically give it a bunch of like existing payloads that work for some like cool subset of libraries for generating, you know, XSS or CSS injection or whatever, and say like, come up with some more ideas. And then I'll put in my tester and then I'll be like, come up with some more ideas. This didn't work. Just over and over again, right? And this
you gotta hook it up to an agent, man. Get it on like Gemini CLI or something.
That's true. Yeah. What I want. Yeah. We can talk more about that after. But the way I used it yesterday actually was generating more paths. Right. We've talked about that a million times, but I think Gemini 3 is going to be even better at that than the other models. So I gave it like the site tree of a banking app I was hacking on and was like, I have to find some other secret things. Actually, this is something kind of interesting that you might have something to say about for the audience on like a way to hack better. It's an app where it's clear that the pages are being totally rendered server side and then served. So like there's no single page app like Voodoo I can do on my side to like, you know, be able to see more functionality or try to like know what paths exist or what objects exist. It's like all executing server side. And I'm sure there's a bunch of different technologies that do that. But anyways, so I was able to basically find like four or five pages by asking Gemini 3 to come up with some paths that are most likely to exist given the ones that it can see do exist. And most of them didn't result in a bug, but one of them did. It was like a delete user endpoint. And whenever I hit it, it was like, oh, I can't delete this user. But then it loaded the full page and showed me all of the users and all their serial numbers and all their usernames for everyone in my org. And as a low privilege user, I was able to execute that. So pretty cool.
Dang, dude. Good find. Yeah. In answer to that question, like, that definitely makes it more tricky. I'm so used to single page applications nowadays and just being able to like, you know, thumb through the JavaScript and like grab pretty much all the routes that are going to be utilized. But I mean, I also think that's a little bit of like a you know, something that we think that we've got all the routes, but we actually don't have all the routes.
That's
right?
True. That's true. I do fuzz a lot of APIs for that reason.
Yeah, I actually don't. And I should. But when the scenario that you mentioned made me think of a live hacking event that I like absolutely destroyed it in. Like, this is a couple years back. I think this was 22. And I think this is still one of the highest earning bug bounty events I've ever been in. And I found this app. It was an older app. It was doing exactly what you said. And everything was vulnerable. Nobody had just gotten access to this thing. Super high paying program. And it was, everything was vulnerable. I was just having the best time of my life. And I was like, I have to find every single
bleeping
page on this app, right? And so I went ham, right? And I was like, I was looking at the routes and I was like trying to figure out the patterns. So my first tip there is like, look at the patterns, you know, figure out, you know, sometimes, this is a tip from Inhibitor 181, Acosman, you know, look at how the path in the URL correlates to class names in the you know, in the actual HTML, how it correlates to like form identifiers, you know, try to correlate between path and URL, or path and like attributes of the HTML. But what I did actually was I just took all the documentation, pulled out all of the words, figured out all of the patterns, you know, of like, okay, you know, this word goes here, this one's capitalized, there's a dash, you know, here's the verb, you know, categorize each word by like what part of speech it is, you know, that sort of thing. And then just had a Python script just generate like a massive, massive list and then threw it at it. And it just like, it found like 15 beautiful. More, dude. It, I mean, definitely mid five figures in bugs. From that little script. I'm like,
So I'm going to go run that. I'm going to go do that. Yeah. I've done that before for other things, but that's a really clutch technique that probably a lot of people aren't necessarily doing where, when you're fuzzing for lots of things, whether it's API endpoints, whether it's parameters or whatever, if you find like their pattern and then create a script that, you know, creates a bunch of, examples of that pattern, that's the best way to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, I don't know, sometimes they don't follow the patterns, right? Especially in the vulnerable apps that are just like thrown together by like six different, you know, developers or whatever. But sometimes they do. And when you do, especially when you're in those situations where it's like, everything is going to be vulnerable if you can find it, you got to hit it.
It's worth it. Yeah. Yeah. This one's one of those ones. Like there were some pages that are called like page XYZ, you know, like they have other ones called like add user, delete user. And then it's like page XYZ and that's modify user. It's like, what are you thinking? Why did you create page XYZ? But oh
my gosh, dude, that's crazy. Yeah. Well, good luck, dude.
On that Gemini 3 front really quickly. Yeah. Thank you. I did want to mention they launch at the same time as something called anti-gravity. People on the pod probably don't realize this, but there was a whole bunch of drama around like Google acquired Windsurf's intellectual property, but not their team. And a bunch of the team kind of got screwed, but then they were like scooped up by a company called Cognition. Long story short is they got the intellectual property of the app Windsurf, which is basically like a cursor clone. And it was like for $2.4 billion. And they have now rebranded Windsurf as, what's it called? Anti-gravity. Yeah. And it's totally free right now. I don't know how long it will be free for, but if anyone wants to go use it, they could go use it for free right now. So if you've been like a holdout on, you know, Cursor or Claude or Codex or whatever, it's basically just a VS Code fork, but now maintained by Google, which is pretty sweet. And it's like an agentic coding platform.
Dude, I cannot imagine being a holdout on Cursor. You know, like how much time are you sacrificing?
I think about this all the time. Even just people who don't have like a subscription to any of the services who just try to use the free tier and not get any of the extra features. It's like you can find bugs in these, which is sweet. And also you're just like, you know, saving $10 or $20 to like lose hours of your life.
So. Yeah, of your time, man. You know, it's like, oh my gosh. But, you know, and it's not thing, I don't know, maybe for some people it is things they enjoy, but for me, it's not things I enjoy. Like I trade my time for things that I like to do, you know, that are menial tasks. Like for example, I could pay someone to come wash my dishes every day, right? Yeah, but it'd be expensive. But, you know, I kind of like being in the kitchen and washing my dishes and, you know, looking out my window and, you know, having the counter be nice and clean when I'm done.
And it's therapeutic. And stuff like that.
Yeah, it's a little therapeutic. The family's around, you know, the kids see you doing house tasks, you know, and that's the other thing about, you know, being a little bit of a high earning person. My brain goes into like, you know, optimization mode, like, yeah, actually, I should pay someone to do that. But no, I mean, I should be, you know, a human, you know, like,
yes.
So
I think it is different culturally, too. Like, I've heard that like a lot of hackers in like Spain or Portugal or other places of the world, like they get a lot of joy actually out of hiring someone to do their housework because they're actually providing jobs to people who really need those jobs locally to them. Whereas in the US, it's like not really as seen as much that way, I feel like. But I mean, in general, I think that, like you said, you love hacking. You love popping like sick bugs. And so if AI writing a script that removes the friction, as you often say, in order to like retest something way more often, it's like now that's probably what you're using AI for the most, right? It's like you're helping AI to reduce the friction so you can find more bugs.
Exactly. Yeah, so. Dude, it's definitely necessary. I freaking love Cursor, dude. I really do.
I don't use it anymore. I'm still Cloud Coding Codex like every day, all day.
Dude, like I don't know, man. Like I don't like that I have a hard time seeing what Cloud Code and Gemini CLI actually have done. Right? Like in Cursor, it's so nice with the green and the red, you know, what they removed, what they added. And if I think I was truly vibe coding where I'm just like, do it.
Yeah.
You know, then I would use that. But, and I do sometimes like when I'm really like, oh, I know that it can one shot this. I'm just going to like throw it in Gemini CLI really quick and it one shots it and it's fine. You know, but when I'm actually doing like large scale code changes and stuff like that, I always use Cursor because I need to, you know, review what it's done every time and be like, no, you didn't need to tweak that. Leave that the way that it is, you know?
Well, I will say this, I often feel like I am argumentative, right?
No, hit me, man.
Well, what I was going to tell you is actually when you use Cloud Code inside of Cursor, it does show you all the diffs on all the pages and all the tabs. It's all integrated perfectly.
What do you mean Cloud Code inside of Cursor?
Just like open up the terminal.
What?
In Cursor. If you run Cloud Code in the terminal in Cursor, it will show you all the diffs. It'll open up the tabs.
What kind of lunatic is doing that? Like, how many layers of AI are you nesting in here, dude?
There's lots of people that do that. Maybe I'm wrong about it being, I'm pretty sure it's in Cursor, but maybe it's in VS Code. But basically, if you have an IDE open, like if you have a VS Code fork open and you're using Cloud Code, it will show you all the tabs so you can see all the files, just like you probably want out of Cursor. And so anyways, it's probably worth a try.
But like Cursor has like that review button where you can click it and it goes through like each.
Yeah, that's fair.
You know, and it walks you through it. I don't know. I feel like that's pretty nice, but I didn't know you could do that. That is kind of interesting.
Yeah, that is neat.
So that's pretty cool. All right. I've got a couple more items and then we'll call it for
today. We
got
to shout out our boy Vitor.
Yeah, let's take a look at that really quickly. Victor, I don't know. Vitor, Victor.
Vitor, but Bus. Just call him Bus. Bus Factor,
Bus,
yeah.
Bus Factor has this awesome website up called Bug Bounty Daily. You guys gotta go check this out. Like I feel like this is where I should just be going right off the bat and just clicking through all of these and like
that's true.
Just reading these every day. But this is a feed of bug bounty articles and essential resources that is being updated each day. He's got an email subscribe button now. You can submit content if you want your content hosted on Bug Bounty Daily. It's kind of like a news aggregator there.
He's also seeding it with old stuff. So he had me send him like my very best write-ups from my blog. Yeah. So it's pretty neat.
It's really high quality stuff and it's by somebody who knows their shit, you know, which is different. Trust me. So I would definitely recommend checking this out and getting, you know, subscribed to that if you're going to try to keep up with bug bounty content. Because it is, I mean, it's a lot. Sometimes you miss stuff on Twitter or whatever. And I think this is a good place to grab the high quality stuff.
I know I'm always mentioning AI stuff. It would be also a pretty cool resource to like set up as like a RAG database. Like if you're asking about AI bugs, like it would look across all those write-ups. It'd be really cool.
Yeah, I think he's working on that.
Okay, sick.
Yeah. Hey, actually, on that note, and I don't know if I'm getting like too technical, like into the weeds of AI stuff.
CTBB.
I know. That's not what I meant to say. But like, it's AI stuff versus like, you know, most of
rather than hacking stuff,
bug bounty stuff. But I don't know exactly how like vector embeddings work. And
I can explain it in like 1 minute. So, okay. But go ahead and finish your question first. Yeah.
Let me ask. So what I'm wondering is whether it is impossible. Or whether it is possible to generate your vector embeddings locally and then send those up to an LLM or whatever, and whether that is possible to reverse those embeddings back to the actual text that they came from.
So the short answer is I'm not a super professional expert on this, but yes, everything I've ever heard is that you can reverse embeddings.
Okay.
And you definitely can run embedding models locally, but most people you do it via API because they run slightly bigger embeddings model at like OpenAI and stuff. There is a company called, I think it's called Cyborg DB, that is like very passionate about this whole like encrypted embeddings thing. I had a call with them recently. Basically they encrypt and have like a parent signing key and then like smaller keys per index. So then like, it's like encrypted. I mean, everything's encrypted at rest, right? But it's like encrypted when it's sitting there live on the file system. So if you're like a company or whatever, and you have, you know, a RAG DB and you don't want, once it gets, if it gets popped for the attackers to be able to access everything, then you could use their system and they would not be able to access it all. So you can like kind of store the embeddings encrypted.
Mm. Yeah, that's very interesting. That's kind of what I was thinking about for it. I was thinking about it from multiple perspectives. One was, you know, if I'm trying to avoid, you know, a bunch of cost, would it be better for me to, you know, do this embeddings calculation on some data locally and then send it up? And also, you know, I know that private compute for AI is like a massive problem, right? Like if we can figure out a way to do private, you know, LLM, right? Without so the model providers being able to see it.
Yeah, the math for the similarity of like the lookup of like what's most similar related to my input is all local and cheap. Mm.
Okay.
So if you so and like and you can use a, your own local RAG database. It's called ChromaDB. It's by far the most popular one.
I've used it before. Yeah.
Yeah. So the what most people's script actually does though is it calls OpenAI's embeddings for your data, but then it stores the embeddings locally and then it does the comparison locally.
Okay.
So like that's no big deal. And all it's doing is doing a cosine similarity difference link. So if you imagine like a 3D plot and there's 2 points in it, it's like, or there's 10 points and you have a new input point, which point is the closest to your point, right? It's going to be the most similar. That's all it's doing. Yeah. And so basically if anybody's curious what embeddings are, I'm going to do that 1 minute explanation that I told I would do for Justin. So an embedding is basically just taking any arbitrary length of text and turning it into a, you know, a number, right? In that graph that I was just talking about. And it can be as small as like one word or it can be as big as like a whole paragraph, right? And so there's lots of optimizations there on like, it can be a whole page. It can be as much text as you want. But, and so I think there's often like, what are you wanting to match for, right? So like, if you're looking for an answer from an FAQ, you would want to embed each question and answer or whatever. So then when a user puts in a question, you would find the most similar question and go ahead and pull that question and answer out of that similarity search into the AI. And then that way the AI can basically like have that as context. So if that actually is the real question, it can answer it depending on no matter how many typos the user has in their query or whatever, it's still going to find it because it's going to be similar. But then obviously the AI will know that that answer, that question answer that was pulled from the RAG database is not the same as the user's asking. It's just similar. And so it might be able to speculate or tell it it doesn't know or what have you. But that's how it works.
Very interesting, man. Very interesting. I feel like I got to go a little bit deeper on this. And I know Drop did a presentation at DEF CON on some RAG related stuff. So I need to go check that out.
I do think there are some cool implications. Like if you embedded all of the requests in the site tree of like Kaito, for example, and then you were asking like login, like you just typed in the word like login requests, it pulled like the most similar five URLs that were like associated with the word login because the path contains the word login or because there's like username and password parameters in the body or whatever, that would probably work. So there's cool things you can do with it.
Is that it's similarity cheap. Calculation local?
Yes, the similarity is local and easy and cheap. And even the embeddings are often cheap. Now you will have to have an embeddings model on your computer, but if you're willing to just like, if you don't think the data is sensitive and you don't mind to ship it off to OpenAI or Google for the embeddings, it's also cheap. Like it's way cheaper to embed text than it is to like run an LLM. So none of this is that expensive. But I do think it would be expensive if you were doing your whole HTTP history. That's why I said the sitemap, because to do a few hundred or a few thousand is no big deal, but you don't want to run this on 50,000 requests, right?
Right. That makes sense. Okay. All right. Well, the brain's going to spin on that. I got something to talk to you about off air about that afterwards. But I'm going to hit this last item, this last news item here. Actually, I'm not going to bother sharing my screen for this one. You guys have probably all heard of AssetNotes Surf utility. This is a utility that they built to hand it a bunch of domains. And then it takes those domains, tries to reach out to them, and anything that's not reachable, either because it's an internal IP or because it's an external IP without HTTP or HTTPS exposed, it puts into a word list for you to try to hit with blind SSRF or SSRF, right? To prove that you can hit internal hosts. So nice. Really awesome tool, super simple, love the concept. We were, Emil and I were kind of vibing on something the other day and actually ended up just building vibe coding a copy of Surf for Kaito directly, because oftentimes you're going to be using Automate to run this actual, SSRF exploitation. So we're like, makes sense to just do it in Kaito and then just press upload as word list, and then it pushes it into your files list. So we went ahead and built that. That's at kaito.com/surf. Probably by the time this airs, we'll have it pushed to the Kaito store. But definitely it makes it a lot easier for you to go ahead and take your massive domain list and then just convert it to a really easy accessible list of URLs that you can pass into your SSRF to prove that you have internal network access.
Yeah, you said kaido.community/surf. It's github.com/kaido-community/surf. Yep.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that one.
Sweet, dude. My last thing was very, very small. It was just a small humble brag. I was excited about it. Douglas messaged me yesterday. I prioritize family like you. I get off at like 4:30.
Yeah.
He messaged me at like 4:28 and was like, "Hey, I got this private invite. You know, do you want to look at it?" And of course, my hacker brain's like, "Oh yeah, I definitely really want to look at this." And my kids are like walking in from the neighbors and we're like supposed to hang out and eat dinner. I'm like, "Yeah, just one second, guys." And I like pull it up. And within like 3 minutes, I had already found that it could render a markdown image. And I'd already made like a really nice payload that would like get it to actually respond with it, even though it had like some guardrails. And it was like, just go figure out delivery, go find delivery. And then eventually a few hours later, he's like, "Oh yeah, I got it in this, you know, nice. This user profile field." And so if an admin asks about their users in this app or whatever, it'll automatically pop it. And it just felt so good.
Freaking love that, man. Like I love it when you pop a vuln quick.
Yeah.
You know, it's so satisfying.
That's like the opposite of imposter syndrome. It's like, oh, I'm a god. You know, for a split second, you're like, I'm the best.
Yeah. Yeah, dude. So. Freaking love that, man.
Hey,
yeah,
one thing we didn't mention earlier that I did want to mention. Not only are we going to give away swag promotional codes or free codes in the Black or in the C-tiers chat next Friday for Black Friday, but we may or may not have some exclusive new swag coming out soon.
Yeah, dude, that's going to be a blast. We had a meeting with the team this morning to kind of design it and get all that figured out. I don't know if it'll be ready by Black Friday, but
maybe they can save their code. How long will the code last? That's the question. Well, people will probably redeem it instantly. So
they got to use it. I don't know. Maybe we'll figure something out for that. But or we could build a little service where it, like, if you're the first to hit it, then
you save it and you can use it in a week or two.
Exactly. Yeah. Then you get,
because it is the perfect Christmas gift. If anybody's looking for things that they're trying to tell their parents, I always struggle to think of things as an adult, like that I don't just buy for myself. You can recommend your parents or, you know, friends or family or something, get you something from the merch store.
Yeah, totally, man. Yeah. Well, that's a good point. We probably should have mentioned that earlier in the episode, but hey, you know, for those of you guys that wait till the end of the episode, you listen to the whole episode, you reap the reward.
The juicy information.
All right, that's a wrap, yeah?
Cool, yep. See you guys. Peace.
Right, peace, y'all. And that's a wrap on this episode of Critical Thinking. Thanks so much for watching to the end, y'all. If you want more Critical Thinking content, or if you want to support the show, head over to ctbb.show/discord. You can hop in the community. There's lots of great high-level hacking discussion happening there, on top of masterclasses, hackalongs, exclusive content, and a full-time hunter's guild if you're a full-time hunter. It's a great time, trust me. All right, I'll see you there. Alrighty, my guy. Happy Thanksgiving.
Dude, what's up? Happy Thanksgiving.
Pretty good, man. This is going to be a good... Oh, you said Happy Thanksgiving, not How Are Thanksgiving.
They do sound really similar.
I reverse processed it. Okay, Richard, we're cutting that. We are cutting that, okay? Uh-huh. Don't do anything weird with that.